Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
So, Guy, Nick Mason, Sourceful of Secrets, of which we are two-fifths, right? We're going back out on the road in the summer across the UK.
We are. It's all of June, so brace yourself.
What's it called?
It's called the Set the Controls Tour. What a brilliant name. Who do you think could have come up with such a great name for a tour, Gary?
I wonder. I think I'm looking at him, right? But then I did come up with Nick Mason, Sourceful of Secrets.
You did, and in fact, that came up in a podcast then because you were inspired by Woody Woodman's U-Boat, weren't you?
I was, yes.
Anyway, but enough of that.
So, join Nick, Guy, Lee Harris, Don Beacon, and me as we celebrate the early years with, you know, that incredible, it's an incredible body of work, isn't it? The early Pink Floyd. It goes up to just before Dark Side of the Moon.
Goes up to 1972, with all the film soundtracks, all the Sid stuff, stuff you've never heard, stuff that no one's ever
heard,
frankly.
Obviously.
Echoes is the big sort of, you know, what is that? What would you call it?
Magnum opus.
Yeah, I love a Magnum, don't you?
Yeah, I never met Magnum. Anyway, tickets are on sale now and you can buy yours at myticket.co.uk.
And Kilimanjaro Live presents Nick Mason's Sourceful of Secrets, the Set the Control Tour.
Hello, Gary.
Hi, Guy.
So, big old legend today.
Yes, he is. Marty Wilde is a rock and roll legend. He's one of the first rock and roll artists ever in Britain after Tommy Steele and Cliff Richard. I mean, we're talking about the 50s.
And the spawner of that rarest of things, a music dynasty.
Yeah, because Kim Wilde is his daughter, and he co-wrote Kids in America and Cambodia with his son Ricky. But I think those early days, he was one. You know, this is what's going to be fascinating to hear the story of Larry Parnes. I mean, how do you
That's
describe
a name
Larry?
To country with Larry Parnes was kind of the kingmaker, was it? He was sort of he found and discovered. He came up with those amazing names, found those kids. He actually had a rock and roll charm school. It was either in Portsmouth or Southampton, where he would groom. Many
the wrong
ways,
word.
His charges.
Yeah, I mean, people like Billy Fury and Georgie Fame as well. He came out of Larry Parnes' school.
Yeah.
But I'm sure Marty has got a lot. Because we're calling him Marty. He's Marty all these years later. But of course, that was one of Larry's inventions, wasn't it?
That's right. He was Reg Smith, which is such a beautifully kind of post-war name, isn't it? It's impossible to hear Reg without thinking of On the Buses if you're our age, isn't it?
It is.
Without thinking of Reg Varney.
Or Ronnie.
In your case,
In
yes.
my case, yeah, yeah. So anyway, we're talking about, you know, songs like Endless Sleep, Sea of Love, Bad Boy, which he wrote because he was one of the first people to actually write his own songs. A Teenager in Love was a massive hit for him. It was actually written by Doc Pomus and Mort Schumann. But he was, I mean, he was, I remember my parents sort of knowing about Marty Wilde because he's sort of their generation. I had the privilege of seeing him play live not that long ago. Boy, he's still got it. He's got some charisma. I'm waiting to see what he's going to be looking like on our screen.
He has. He did. I know he. My mum has mentioned him, because obviously my dad was part of that. But early, slightly before. Well, it wasn't before him, but I think, I don't know if they crossed paths with Tommy Steele.
Because
we'll find out.
Lionel Bart helped discover him, didn't he?
That's right, yeah. Lionel Bart spotted him and told Larry Parnes about him.
Let's get him on.
Welcome to the Rock on Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
That's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
That caused a big problem in the band, actually.
I was having too much fun.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it, and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
Well, I get the feeling that us three should go for a pint. That's what I think.
I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
To get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock On Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Keep on rocking!
Marty.
How are you, Gary?
Oh, mate. Lovely to hear your voice. wow. Hey. You're in a beautiful garden. You look the biz.
Hello, Marty. Lovely to meet you. Guy Pratt.
Hi there. Nice to meet you as well.
And do you know what? I see you're in a lovely garden, and I know you're a very, very keen gardener, as indeed is Kim. And I was hoping, because my missus is a nuts gardener, and I was hoping to position my computer to show you ours, but there's just too much sun here.
Yeah, well, it's a very, very hot day. This is one of the hottest, I think. I've got a feeling it's going to be anyway.
You were saying there's a Zoom story.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I got caught doing 35 in a 30-mile area in South London. And so I got the naughty boy treatment, and I've got a 3 points on the license if I don't do this meeting. And you can do it by Zoom. And we found that out. So we had it all set up yesterday, and the guy comes on, and then I was in my office then, which is just down there, and it was part of the building, but it couldn't take it. It couldn't do it. And first of all, I saw him clear as a bell, talking to him. Yeah, all ready? Yeah, you ready to join the meeting? Yeah. And then suddenly, bang, that was it was off, and it cost you money as well, because if you don't do the meeting, you just move it on to another time. But I want you to do the meeting as well, because I think it's important. I shouldn't be a naughty boy, but 35 mile an hour in a 30 mile area, it's not...
Yeah, I got done for 27 the other day. but listen, you're an old rock and roller. Yeah,
but that was in a shopping mall, though, wasn't it? Yeah.
I'm hoping you were caught speeding in a Corvette or something, or a Thunderbird. Exactly. Would be more apt.
No, to it was in an S500, and that was, I'll tell you, I'd been doing some speed before that as well. So, oh my goodness, I'd have probably been, I mean, some of the speeds I have done in the past, unbelievable, even quite recently. And I know this meeting is going to change my attitude, this Zoom meeting with them. I've got it this afternoon, and I know it would change my attitude to everything to do with speed, because one of my guitarists has had to go through the same course, and he was telling me, you know, it does change, it's going to change my world. But that's never a bad thing. I mean, I'm 84 now. I love acceleration, and I love my car to bits. I go on about it, because it's an S500. I think it's the best Mercedes that they ever made, apart from the S600, which I had one of those as well. But I know I sound a bit flash, but I'm not really. But
we should get you in a room with Nick Mason talking cars.
Yeah. Oh, he loves cars, does he? Oh, I love cars.
Oh, mate, he did. Yeah,
it's got one of everything.
Yeah. yeah. You're on tour, aren't you, Marty? Or you're going on tour?
No, I do gigs. I do gigs around the country. That's the way I view it now. I think possibly my touring days, I think, are over. I think those days are gone, which is sad, really, for me. I mean, I know Eden Kane, who's a dear friend of mine, gets in touch with me from Hollywood, where he is, but we can't, you know. There's no call for it, really. And things move on, you know. And funny enough, my granddaughter has just been to see Harry Styles. And Ricky took, because it's my great-granddaughter, sorry, my great-granddaughter. And Ricky took his granddaughter to see Harry Styles. And they show us on the telephone, you know. It was absolutely, I think it's the O2 or somewhere. Like, no, it's Wembley, isn't it? Five nights at Wembley. Wow, you know, if I get 300 in, I'm happy.
But, Marty, don't you think it's about when you, can you imagine you back in the 50s? Did you have any thought back then that you would be in your 80s going, oh, I don't know if I want to keep touring?
Yeah.
I mean, that seems extraordinary, doesn't it?
I never even thought of that. It never came into my head. The only thing I can remember saying was when the press were pushing for quotes from me, because I just started my career. And they said, how long is this situation with rock and roll going to last? I said, it'll last a long, long time. I said, it's the biggest influence. I said, there's classical music I would say jazz and rock and roll. They are the three biggest rock and roll music. The music influence is colossal. And I said it will impact into other forms of music as time goes on. So I was right, you know. Sometimes
you were.
You absolutely were.
Sometimes.
You're a sage, Martin.
But I guess back then as well, in the late 50s, there was a lot of race implications about rock and roll. Was there a sense that that was music that was from a different culture?
I don't know. I don't think so. No, not so much that. I think it just frightened the parents because it was the first time really that teenagers after the war, that you're talking about the 50s, they just learnt that they had a voice. They knew they could do something. I think teenagers before us were pretty subservient. I mean, in some ways, you wish they were now in these days, you know, so they would do exactly as they're told, you know.
What, you mean drive at the right speed?
Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
But did you do conscription? Were you conscripted?
No. I could tell you the story of that. I have told the story many times, but my father was a sergeant in Sandhurst, trained sergeant. And he said, look, son, he said, you're going to have to do, you know, they called you up. You're going to have to go. You're going to go for your medical. He said, now get in there and make the best of it. Make the best of it. Don't go in because Terry Dean had had an awful time and had been pilloried by the press.
Oh, he was another Larry Parnes boy, wasn't he, Terry?
Yeah. No, he wasn't. Not at that point, he wasn't. So anyway, he'd been pilloried by the press and they kicked him out of the army. So anyway, I went for my medical. And then there was a question over my medical again, and I had to go down to St. Alfred's Hospital, I always remember, in Greenwich. And the doctor said, looked at my notes that had been given to him, and he said, don't think you're going to get away with this. He said, you're going in the army. I said, I'm not come here to beg you. I said, it's nothing to do with me. I said, I've been given this note to hand to you. You're the doc. You're another doctor who's got to view my health. So he said, well, you're going to go in the army. So I thought, okay. So I said, oh, by the way, I've got a letter for you here. And I gave him a letter. And I'd been to London, and then Parnes had given me this letter. From one of the top doctors to say that I was, you know, I had flat feet. In other words, and I remember him reading it. In other words, you know, he was like this doctor in a certain hospital, but he wasn't that power man, you know, he wasn't the power doctor, and he had to do as he's told. And he looked at me, and I thought, well, I said, don't look at me, I don't know anything about it, which I didn't. Parnes got me off of that. He must have cost him a fortune. But it was worth it for him because I was. In those days, you know, I was just starting to be a big star. Well, fairly big rock and roll star. So, yeah, you know, that's exactly what happened. It was strange. Strange to say, it was great in a way. It's about this guy, he was a chippy guy, you know. And I said, I'm not here to argue. I don't mind going in the army. He said, well, you're going to go. I said, oh, by the way, I've got a letter for you. Bang. And that was it. Oh, my God. His face dropped a mile. We remember that. God. Things we do.
Yeah, my dad did do national service, and it was when he came back that he went to London and met up with Lionel Pratt.
Oh, right.
Because I think, did you know Mike Pratt?
Yeah, just briefly, yeah, I did, yeah. I certainly know Lionel Bart. My God, he was Ricky's godfather.
Ah.
Mike and Lionel, Mike's guy's dad, and they obviously wrote, you know, songs for Tommy Steele and those early days.
Right.
We will get on to Lionel Bart.
Yeah.
But I just want to know, because he discovered you along with Larry, didn't he? But I'd really like to know a bit more about your musical background as a kid.
Because you were talking about your dad, but he really encouraged you from a very early age, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. Like, I mean, a lot of parents do. You know, you see it today. I see it with my own grandchildren and my great-grandchildren. I see Ricky encouraging them. They're obviously going to be singers or going to try to be singers or whatever. But yeah, he did. I mean, I remember when Dad was in the army. I can remember a sort of this brief memory of being wrapped in a big army overcoat, and they would pull me out, and it was full of soldiers, because my father was a sergeant then, and it was full of soldiers and all dressed in army kit, and they all cheered, and I came out, and they got me to sing this little song, and it was called the son of Sergeant Smithy, because Smith is our real name and still is. And so I sang the song of Sergeant Smithy, and they all applauded. And that was probably my first taste of stardom, because once you start getting applause for things, that's when it changes. That's when your ego is in. It helps a hell of a lot. It's like you get something. You're not going to forget that. You know, I wasn't very good at anything else, and then with musically, that I was encouraged, obviously, to. Dad would sing around the house all the time. And one of the things which was great with Dad, he when the radio came on in those days, which it was pretty old fashioned music, some of it, but lovely songs, or great songs, some great writers, Dad would harmonize. Dad would never sing the song. He'd always, whatever it was, he would harmonize. So as a young child, I learned to harmonize pretty quick. And I used to harmonize to all the songs as they came out. And this continued. It played a part in my life in so much as I wasn't very interested in school at all. All I was interested in was music. So I used to look out the window, and there was a big factory nearby. And I used to look out and watch them at work in the factory. And they'd say, "Smith." I'd say, "Sorry, sir." "Smith, what did I just say?" And I'd say, "Come out here," and then I'd be in trouble again. And I was always singing to the boys and tapping, and music would be in my head all the time. And I couldn't stop it. It was peculiar. And anyway, that carried on. And then one day in school, a guy called Jimmy Monday, I remember his name, old Jimmy.
Jimmy
Monday. Yeah, sounds like a song, doesn't it?
It's like a Larry Parnes
It is.
And he bought a ukulele. And I said, "What's this? It's great, Jim. What's that?" And he started playing this chord. I said, "Oh, wow. Oh, my goodness. That's great. How do you do that?" He said, "Just put your little finger there on there." He said, "Right." I said, "Oh, what's that? What's it?" He said, "G, I think it was. I remember the uke." So I said, "Oh, yeah." And this is C. "Oh, yeah." "And that's D." "Yeah." "Oh, my goodness me. Show me again, Jim." Of course, then I said to Dad, "Could I have a..." Because time had moved on now. Dad had come out of the army, and he was a tram driver, poor lad, like all those so many talented servicemen. They had no real job. They couldn't fulfill their you know, their potential. But anyway, and I said, "Dad, you know, this guy at school's got a ukulele. Could you buy me one? I've seen one at Pockets, which is a secondhand shop in Trafalgar Road." So he said, "No, well, I can't." He said, "Because we're on strike at the moment." I said, "Oh, well, could you come and see it with me?" So he came over to Pockets, and we stood outside the shop, and it was hanging. It was a Keach ukulele hanging in there. Anyway, long story, you can imagine, I got it. And then that was it. And then then the trams moved on to the buses. It was like a progression, I suppose. And the buses, they used to let the drivers go out on to trips to South End or Margate, you know.
Yeah, I did that once. My neighbour was a bus driver. We all went to South End on his Red Rover, on his double decker.
Well, you imagine upstairs at the top, right up the top, right in the front. I'd have my ukulele, and then I would sing, you know, a Little Brown Jug or the simplest songs. But they loved it, and of course. This duffer in school, this boy that was always being told off by the teachers and didn't feel, you know, good about himself, felt wonderful when I would see their faces. Yeah. And that has retained itself. It's with me all the time. You know,
what music were you listening to at home, or turned you on anyway?
Well, there was nothing turned me on. There was no choice. There was, all you had was you had things like Ted Heath, which the band later on, of course, I was able to appreciate how good the musicians of the band was. But at that time, that wasn't me. And I wasn't Billy Cotton, you know. I respected Billy Cotton very much so. But that wasn't my music. Palm Court Hall Orchestra, that was awful. On a Sunday night, I used to lie in bed, listen to this Palm Court Hotel, I think it was called. And they would play all this terrible Victorian type stuff. And I always had visions of ferns and people dancing in gay costumes, and it was so damn boring.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I there was nothing that I liked, and that that changed completely, not totally, but completely when Guy Mitchell came along and Frankie Lane. Frankie was my favorite. Big influence, Frankie. I love Frankie, still do. Guy Mitchell, I loved some of the work that was done on his records. There was a track called Cloud Lucky Seven, which has French horns in it. And I love that. That intrigued me because I like classical music. My teacher in school got me interested in classical music as well. So they were the early influences. There was
Frankie Lane. He did lots of westerns, didn't he? Like what was his famous? There was a famous western soundtrack he did. Like he did the songs. Rawhide or something.
He did Rawhide.
All I'm thinking is that there's this kind of Americana, isn't there, that's starting to come in. You've got your parents' generation that are very, you know, Victorian Palm Court, and then you've got this American influence coming in with westerns and that. Because I mean, obviously, what you end up doing is pure Americana, isn't it?
Really? Yeah.
But I would say, weren't you going, is that you talk about this love of classical music, and I think that's something that really comes through all of your songs from the really early ones on. They always have some kind of quite sophisticated instrumental motif or some sort of classical instrument in them or something. It wasn't straightforward bass guitar drums. And it's almost like, as well as the Americana, that seeped into your stuff as well.
Yeah, it did. It came into Kim's career as well. When we were doing Kids in America, I wanted French horns and that towards the end of the track. So only tiny little things like that, but they are big influences. You know, it was the same with Gary, when he was playing, and when he plays, it's those little just tiny things sometimes that come in. But classical music, as I say, I adored it. And this teacher was, he opened up a whole new world for me, really. Thankfully I've managed to retain, I keep that passion. I mean, also I'll move on though. I'll move up from where Frankie. Yeah. And then of course, this rock and roll came across and I started to read about it. And I formed a little skiffle group in school with heavily influenced obviously by Lonnie Donegan. But I'd learnt from the ukulele. I bought a guitar when I was 13, and so I started to play these because the chords are very simple chords. And they're the same, almost the same as a uke. There wasn't a lot of difference initially. The C and the G and the D, they were very, very similar. So off I went. I was playing a guitar. Skiffle came in. I had a head start. And so I could sing all these songs that Lonnie was singing. And I formed a group with the guys, which is quite humorous in a way, because I've still got the books and everything from the past, the books that I had. And I've got, I had the positions. I was very controlling. I had the positions where the band were going to have to stand. How much are we going to have get paid? Jim had 1/6. It's hysterical, really. And I had 2/6. I had more. Something like that. And
singers. Singers.
Was it washboard and T-chest?
Yeah,
bass?
It was T-chest. But yeah, I've got a photograph. I've got a lovely picture of that. Funny enough, so someone from who knew me when I was at school sent me in a couple of pictures to Joyce the other day of the T-chest bass of Phil. Oh, bless him. Stomping away, but we were starting to get a name. We were starting to get popular.
What was the name?
The Hound Dogs. We were Red Smith and the Hound Dogs.
Okay, so hang on,
but the song Hound Dog isn't out yet.
No, but the record.
Sorry, Gary.
No, that's exactly what I was going to say.
It wasn't, but it was a kind of that was a kind of a crossover. Because what happened was, When Elvis came out, I went to the tour. First of all, I went to see Bill Haley. I went to see Black Ball Jungle, the film.
Sidney Poitier.
His music opens it up. Rock Around the Clock. Stunning rhythm record. Still one of the greatest rock records ever made. Not my cup of tea, but still one of the greatest records.
My parents went to see him at the London Palladium. It was one of their first dates. And my dad talked a lot about the balcony that they were standing on. Just he felt it pumping up and down.
And also, Marty, because you're hearing it in a film, that's at a volume and a power that you're never hearing any other music.
Yes, you're
at.
Exactly right. Very observant. Yeah, I never thought of that, but you're dead right. And you know, 1, 2, 3 o'clock, and off it goes. And I thought, my God, the voice didn't impress me all that much. The bluesy feel, there was a little bit of a blues, country blues to it, a little bit of that. But it was catchy, quite a catchy melody. But the rhythm, it was the rhythm. Yeah. And I went out of that cinema. I was walking on air. And the next day, I saw the boys at school. I said, right, skiffle out. I said, it's going to be all rock and roll. And that's when we, then I said, we changed, I can't remember their first name, but anyway, we're going to be called, and that later on, when Elvis came out, I switched it to the Hound Dogs. That's what we became eventually. That's how that rock and roll influence with me started. It all started with Bill Haley, but Elvis was the one that really clinched it. He flattened me completely. He flattened me. I'd never been so influenced in all my, that first album, which is still a classic album, was the one. It hit me. Mm-hmm. It's a jiffy. It hit me with an iron bar.
I mean, honestly, that's a piece of the cross, isn't it? That's like when St. Paul came over and started preaching to the Europeans, and we all embraced Christianity. That first album is religion, isn't it?
It was
of rock and roll.
Oh, it was.
Also as well, Marty, from the way you've been talking about the music you listened to and all the stuff you liked and the stuff you didn't like, there gets a feeling not only of this being incredible for you, but like, here it is. This is what I was waiting for.
It was iconic. I was walking on air when I came out that cinema, and I knew in my heart, I just knew it. It was just an instinctive and natural to want to dance to that, you know, and to want to sing to it. So when we'd been entered, funnily enough, for a skiffle competition, and we started to go down really well with people. And we went to this place, it was somewhere in the south, and it was a big place. It was like a festival. And there were, you know, quite a few thousand there. And they said, right, you're on now. And I said, okay, well, we'll do rock and roll. And of course, then the guy came on and said, I'm sorry, but you've got to stop. This is a skiffle competition. And they kicked us out. So we got kicked out for singing rock.
So what happens? Does the T-chess bass just vanish and become an electric bass or a stand-up? What happens?
No, it was stand-up. Rock and roll wasn't electric bass. It was stand-up bass.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, rock and roll was. It was the T-chess, and then that's for the people that... You know,
it was drums, wasn't it? It's about drums, essentially. Rock and roll.
And at that point, you know, all you needed was the bass. Obviously, would be a colossal bonus and a must. But at that point, it didn't really matter. All it meant was that's what you wanted, that rhythm, bang, 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 and anything you could tap to, you know.
And Elvis must have changed your voice as well.
Completely. Oh yeah, completely. Although I still love Frankie. I still used to love Frankie, but I could never sing like Frankie. I couldn't. He had good vibrato, and he had he was very different. He was a different influence as a singer. But I loved him to bits. But Elvis was I could sing a lot of those songs, and not as well as Elvis, but I could sing them, and that was the link, and that's probably the link still today with people and bands. You know, people, if you can play something that someone's playing, you're at a colossal advantage, and you're linked to them in a funny kind of way.
What I was saying earlier, because I'm trying to picture this, and I reckon I think it must have been happening. This sort of love of America was defining your generation, wasn't it? Music and culture that your parents had no desire to become.
No, they didn't. I mean, I think my father used to look at me in a strange way. You know, what is this guy? You know, what has my son got into? You know, how long is this going to last? A couple of weeks, and then he'll kick him out. You know, but I never planned a lot. I just did what I wanted to do. It became very naturally. To me, most of the things in my life musically have always been very natural. They just happen to me. I don't think too much about them. I don't go into depth. Not really. It's just an instinct. Music is part of my very soul. I know it is.
I think you're being a little unfair to yourself. I wouldn't say that things happen to you. You tend to action them And I mean, right from the beginning, you were writing songs before anyone else was, for, you know, for themselves.
Well, that was born out of frustration because Cliff was getting all the songs. Sammy Samwell, who was I think was a brilliant rock and roll writer. In fact, I mention him on stage these days. He's very, very underrated. Should be mentioned a lot. Sammy Samwell, those early songs that Cliff recorded, if Elvis had done them, that Elvis could easily have cut them as well. And they would have been monster work.
Move On.
You know.
Songs like Move On. Move It.
Yeah, Move It. Nine Times Out of Ten. And dozens more. I mean, Dynamite was a terrific rock and roll song. And a pretty good lyric as well. The lyric was, had a little bit of thought to it. A bit more than just, you know, just around a simple lyric. In fact, I do Dynamite in my stage app. We've just changed some of the chords out, so we're trying to make it just a little bit more modern. But it's he was a great writer, and he was writing these songs for Cliff. And I thought, you know, damn this, you know, this is crazy. And I thought, well, and I had been writing. It was all trash, and so I don't know where the idea from Bad Boy came, but you know, I remember being on the underground with somebody, and I was writing. I had some of the lyrics, and I started to write the lyrics down. And I remember I was on the underground writing with a biro, and an early biro, and a piece of paper. And of course, it became a hit. So, but because it's one of the areas that I've always, up until I was much later in life, it's something I didn't really work on. I should have done. I should have taken time out and said to Larry, you know, I don't want to, you know, I just want to take time out writing, but I never did. And there was always something else around the corner. You know, we want you here, we want you there. And I mean, you write yourself, and any writer knows, you know, you can't have too many distractions. I can't go out and do something in the daytime. I need to be on my own, focused. You know, very. Yeah,
you can't have Amazon ringing the doorbell, can you?
No, you can't.
But can we just go back to Bad Boy? Because this is the proto rock and roll punk everything song. It's the template for every. That's. I mean, had you seen The Wild One, the movie, at this point? You hadn't. Because that's what it is, isn't it? It's that guy, and it's become the black motorcycle jacket. You're talking about that guy who is. Who is it? Who is kind of everything?
The rebel, the rock and roll rebel.
No, I hadn't seen that. No,
that's amazing.
And who wrote the music for Bad Boy?
Oh no, it was me. I wrote it. I just wanted to. When in those days, you know, the chords. I was because I'd been raised on skiffle chords, which were, you know, just basically A, D, you know, E, D, G, E. C. F occasionally if you were dangerous, but, you know,
no minors.
You've already said too many.
Yeah, you've got all the punks confused.
But we need to
go back though before then, because obviously the Larry Parnes discovery. Yeah. You were singing in clubs though, weren't you, as Reg Smith? Weren't you speaking like the Condor? What were the names of the clubs that you
it
were?
Was the Condor
out in?
Club was one of them.
It was the
and
Condor,
Churchill,
which was posh, right?
Churchill's it was. Churchill's was the club in London. I don't know if it's.
So I'm taking that wasn't with your rock and roll band. No.
I'd been spotted by a guy called. I'm trying to think of his name now, but I'll think in a minute. Joe Brunelli, a Canadian, lovely man. This was before Larry. And he'd heard me, and a really sweet guy. I wish in a way he'd be my manager, but he didn't have the power and the contacts that Larry had. But he got me 2 weeks' work. And on the second week, which is at the Condors Club in Soho, I didn't know it because I'd left the club. And Lionel Bart had seen me and had said to Larry, there's a guy, young guy down there who's going down well. He's a rock and roll singer. And of course, there weren't, you know, you couldn't grab them off trees. And obviously, Larry was looking for more rock and roll stars. And I just happened to be there at that point when Bart saw me. I never met Bart until much later. Didn't even know him.
Oh, yeah. Wow. No. Oh, that's it. Oh, okay. That's what I wanted. So you wouldn't have seen my dad then if you're... No.
Gotcha.
No, okay. But I used to go up to with my buddies, and I used to go to church, Baptist church in Blackheath on a Sunday, basically to meet girls and basically to meet the boys.
I've heard you say this before, and the idea of you're the only person I've ever said they went to church on the
plane. Yeah, don't worry. I wasn't there for religion, I can assure you. Yeah. I wasn't. That was the last thing on my mind.
It's where people always used to meet. It's a classic.
Yeah, it's like you've already become a singer. That's not enough. I'm going to try church as well.
No, I wasn't a singer at that point. I was in my skiffle band. But I got the bus home from Blackheath down to Greenwich. I got indoors and Mum said, there's been a man at the door who wants to sign you up. I said, what's to sign me up? She said, yes, he wants to sign you as an artist. I said, well, why? Who is it? She said, it's a man called, she said, I'll find it out, Larry Barnes. I said, Larry Barnes, oh, my God, Mum, do you know who that is? She said, no. I said, that's Tommy Steele's manager. I said, he's the biggest thing in the country. She said, well, he wants to sign you and he's coming back. I said, you're joking. She said, no, he's coming back. He's coming back today. Oh, was it today or the next day? The next day.
This is like Simon Cowell, right?
He was, in some ways, he was
Mickey Mouse.
Simon Cowell rolled into one. Yeah. And there was a knock at the door the next day, and there it was. I had the contract, 60-40. I always remember that.
62.
I had 60 for me. He had 40%. And I couldn't sign it because I was too young. Mum signed it. Mum and Dad signed it. And that was it. I was off.
Because he wanted to give you a wage, isn't it? Wasn't that another option?
No, I would never have accepted that. I won't say. Yeah. I won't mention who. One of his old signed artists, some of them complain like mad about you know, I went on, you know, I was only paid. That's their fault. That was their fault. I would never have done it. I had too much. I wouldn't say confidence, but there was something in me that thought, no, that's second best. At least, you know, at least with... And if it had been 50-50, I wouldn't mind it because the contacts and that opportunity, but it was 60-40.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This episode of Rock on Tours is sponsored by AG1, the daily nutrition supplement.
AG1 is a comprehensive and convenient blend of over 70 vitamins, minerals, and other vital ingredients like gut-friendly bacteria, antioxidants, and much more.
Just one scoop of AG1 daily has all the nutrients you need to support your mental performance, energy levels, heart health, and immune system.
To be honest, it's pretty vital stuff for us, because when you've got a life on the road and you're short of time, or you're too busy to plan and prepare healthy meals, you're getting your podcast together, you're being shouted at, and it's just a nightmare, AG1 gives me all the good stuff and helps keep my energy levels where I need, ready for showtime or doing the podcast, and with a nice vanilla taste.
It keeps me focused, feeling good, feeling healthy with its daily dose of vitamin C and zinc. And it's so easy to use. Just one scoop a day gives me over 70 carefully selected ingredients. Simple.
Trusted by Olympians, F1 drivers and the Rock on Tours. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and a free 1 year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription.
Go to drinkag1.com/rockontours. That's drinkag1.com/rockontours. Check it out.
And did he want to change your name immediately? Was that discussion?
Yes, he did. He said, because I was Reginald Leonard Smith, which I still am. That's still on my passport, still on my driving license.
What does your wife call you?
Just.
And where do you go to prison, Marty?
Well, anyway, he said, look, your name, I know what you mean. I said, I don't like Reg. So I said, I'd like to change that. He said, yeah, I would like to change that. He said, no, don't, what? He said, what name would you like? I said, Patterson. And Larry said, Patterson? He said, why? So I said, well, I like boxing, heavyweight boxing, and Floyd Patterson is world champion. Okay. So he said, all right, you want Patterson? He said, I want Wild. I said, Wild? What's that? He said, well, that's the way you are. Part of your nature is you've got a bit of that in you, all right? I said, Wild. And he said, and also, instead of Reg, I want Marty. Oh, Larry. I said, oh, my God, that sounds like some sort of little college, fat little college boy from America with a red face, you know. Marty, that's appalling. So he said, look, he said, we'll toss a coin for it. I said, okay, we'll toss a coin. He got the coin. I checked out the coin, and he won it twice. Typical Larry. Anyway, I went home and I said to Mum, guess what he's called me, Mum? She said, what? I said, Marty Wild. She said, oh, should I like the name Marty? So I said, oh, God, Mum. I said, it's terrible. She said, no, I quite like that name. And around about 3 weeks later, he'd put my a month later, he'd put my name on a bill. And it was Marty Wild singing so-and-so. And I thought, wow, he don't look bad. It was like Suxi and the Banshees.
I just want a moment where I made a note of some of Larry Parnes's acts and the names, right? Yeah. So Billy Fury, obviously, yeah. Vince Eager,
yeah.
Dickie Pride,
yeah.
Lance Fortune, Duffy Power, yeah. Johnny Gentle, of course, Georgie Fame.
But
the bit I like the most is Joe Brown stood up against him. He said, you're not changing my name, because he wanted it to be Elmer Twitch.
Oh, that's right, yes. Ah, oh, dear Joe, yeah, my dear friend.
But what was Larry like?
He was an interesting character. He knew nothing about music. Yeah, and I learned that from an early stage. You know, he'd say to me, that brass part's really good. And I'd say, that's not brass, Larry. He said, that's a brass part, Marty. I said, that is a guitar with a bit of distortion. Things like that. And I thought, no, you know nothing. You know nothing about it. And I always remember as well, one day, one of the guys rang they were abroad. And they said, we've just heard this song. You should cut it. What is it? He said, well, listen, I'll play it to you over the phone. It's called Valare. And we all listened to it and said, it's crap. He said, no, it's going to be a huge hit. We said, no, it'll never be a hit. Anyway, that's just an aside. But no, he didn't. What was he like as a person? He was, he could be an absolute sod. He could be a bit of a naughty boy in many ways with people that he didn't like. He liked me, I think, because I wasn't one of these tough guys. I wasn't a hard faced. I never have been, and so I used to speak it as it was, as honestly as I could. No flaws, no sort of, you know, design around it. Just me talking straight, and I think he respected that. He did respect that, but some of the others, he you know, I always remember with Big Jim Sullivan, my wonderful guitarist. We came off a train at Euston and with Brian Bennett and all that. We all got off and we all had our equipment. So Larry said to this porter. And that's how he would talk like that. Porter, come here. So the porter came up when they had this. He said, could you give me a trolley, please? And we put all this equipment on. So he said, yes, sir. And he tipped his hat, whatever, like that. And he brings up this big trolley and on goes the amplifier and on goes the guitar and then on goes we had a double bass as well, I think, is that a double bass? Goes another amplifier and another guitar. Yeah, that goes on. And he eventually got it all in and they put the clothes on as well. And they're all in this, make sure they're all on the top and hanging up, not hanging up, but lying on the top. They're lying on the top, right. So the guy's wheeling it down there, and Larry said, I'm going now. He said, Jim, come here a minute. He said, Jim, give him a tip. And he gave Jim threepenny piece, which was nothing, absolutely nothing. And I also remember this porter picking, he said, what is this? The poor old Jim had to face it. But, I mean, I got very, very close to him. He was, he was a dangerous time for him because his life was a different kind of life, and he could have gone to prison for what was around him at that particular point in time. And so we had a deal that he would live his life, I'd nothing to do with me, and I would live my life, and he would not interfere in my personal life, and I would never interfere in his. And that was kind of a deal that we had right through our lives. And I loved him in the end. I got to really care for him. And he was a tough guy to, in some ways, to get to know. Very good looking man, very charismatic, very good looking man. And he's a funny guy, really. He would give that porter threepenny piece after doing all that work. And he would, if he found a stray animal, a stray cat, or a stray dog, he would take that dog, and he would spend, even in those days, he would have spent £1,000 on it to get it. Yeah. He was that kind of a character. I was there to work for him and to do as best that I could. And he did the best for me as well. So it was a good partnership in many, many ways.
But what about John Kennedy? Because weren't they partners?
No, that's right. Kennedy is very rarely mentioned. That's because...
Exactly. I always wondered about that. He was kind of the power behind the throne.
He, in many ways, yeah. He was. Well, he was a press man. He was a press... Larry was a businessman and the good-looking guy. Mind you, Kennedy was a good-looking guy as well. But Kennedy was the press man. He could get any paper. Right. And I'll give you an example. We were in Battersea Park. In those early days at that big, like a park, which is and fun fair and all that business. I don't know if it's still there. It probably still is. I don't go down that way, but.
No, it's gone.
Well, I went there and it was packed, and I was a star and at the time. And we were there and we were with a girl, a starlet that Larry had got. They'd found this starlet to come with me. So the starlet would be with me. And Swanson, her name was, I remember. She was a lovely kid as well. And so we were, and Rippingale, Keith Rippingale was the guy who was with me. He was the road manager. And we were in Battersea, thing, thousands of people. And what's called, he said, we need some press. John said, we need some press. He said, I know. Gloria, whatever her name, I can't remember her first name. I think it was Gloria Swanson. He said, come here. He ripped the back of her dress right down to her backside almost. And he said, right, Marty, you stand here. And he'd had a photographer coming around with us all the way. And it was that Marty Wilde had saved this young girl from shame and everything else. Front page. Front page. It made all the newspapers. And another time, which was awful, was another time we were on a coach and we were on tour. And they said, we need some more publicity for these future dates. That we could get more people in. So he said, right, you've been in a terrible fire. I said, been what? He said, you've been in a fire and you're injured. He said, when we arrive at the theatre, we're going to call them ahead and tell them that you're badly, badly injured, but you bravely are going to turn up as the man that you are, the rock and roll singer who loves his audience despite terrible injuries.
Disfigurement.
I said, what are you talking about? So they stopped to the chemist shop, got all these bandages, and they, I tell you, man, they wrapped me up like a mummy, and I blow my head and everything. Yeah. And when I got there, of course, all the press were there. The press were there, all right. But Marty Wilde had been badly injured, and there were it was in the north, and again, front page, that was what.
How long did it take you to recover? The next day.
Do you have to have skin grafts and stuff to make it authentic?
It's more like Tom and Jerry.
In those days, you just moved on and everyone forgot about it.
When did Mickey Most come into your life?
Mickey came into my life. I met Mickey many years before we ever did business together in South Africa. He was a big star in South Africa, a singer. And then he also, him and his, he had a guy who wasn't his brother, Alex. They toured together on my early bills. So the first, in fact, the first tour I ever did, it's in my, it's the bills still up there on the wall. And it was the Most Brothers, and he was part of a duo, and they would sing, and they were, they weren't very good, I'm telling you.
I've seen those posters in Rack Studio. They're still there.
Well, I mean, then later, obviously, with Mickey came in, Ricky took a demo down to Mickey with Ricky singing. And it was a great track as well. Ricky could have had a solo career. But he, Kim had gone down with him and was standing with him. And he said to Ricky later on, "Who's the girl?" He said, "It's my sister." Oh, he said, "Interesting." He said, "Oh, okay. Can she sing?" And that was how that whole thing started. And Rick said, because he had a track called Falling Out, which was, I thought, was a great pop track at that time, a very commercial. And he'd written it, not me. And so he said, "Mickey wants a song for Kim." I said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "For Kim, not you." He said, "No, he wants Kim." Said, "Okay." And that's how it started. It was written in this house. Kids in America was written in the house. And I'll always remember he'd come up with this melody line and the chords, and I liked it. There was something about it I liked. I'd been seeing this program about American children, and it really frightened me. And I thought, my God, you know, what are they going to grow up like, these American kids? And this was in the 80s, you know, about 1979, 80. I'd been reading up a lot about American youth. And some of it, they were so hard-faced. I thought, God, will they ever soften down and become, you know, just normal people? So when Kids in America was written, it was very pro-women, because it was a woman was in charge. A man, it was, she's telling him, you know, "You don't check your watch with me, mate, you know, you do what I'm told." And I wrote that because that's the way I viewed the American youth at that time. And then when we got in the studio, that was the strength of us. The two of us was, with my background, which was completely different to Rick's, but I would introduce things to him, but he would really introduce so many things to me, sound-wise and chord-wise and everything else. And we learned from each other, really. And that was the strength of us as a team, no question.
Well, that's what is fantastic, is that, you know, those early records of yours, what's interesting, a lot of those 50s records, I would say, sound better than early 60s in terms of technical recording. Like, the sound of your records is fantastic, and you're defining a sort of zeitgeist then. And then Kids in America is absolutely exactly the sound of that time.
It was.
I mean, it's a brilliant thing to be able to bridge,
yeah, know, amazing,
that big a time in popular music.
It was, and it was the advent of the, you know, there was a record called Autobahn, and that Ricky got this...
Kraftwerk.
Yeah, and Ricky had got the record, and he said, "Dad, listen to this." He said, "It's all computers." And I da 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 ba. I loved it. I thought, "Oh well, this is something different. This is something great." And then, of course, that was it. I was hooked, and I still am. I'm still hooked on computers. I love computers, and I know they've come back in many ways. They never go. They won't ever go away. There'll always be a place for them musically. I'm sure they will. The most scary thing in the future is, I mean, they're talking about A1. They're talking about
AI.
AI. Sorry, I call it the A1 because that's what.
No, that's where you got done for speeding.
What for gap?
I got done on the AI. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, they.
I feel like I jumped a massive gap with bringing in Mickey Most. Obviously, like two decades, but you developed as a songwriter after your success as a pop star. You carried on as a songwriter. In fact, you wrote for Lulu. You wrote for Status Quo.
Yeah, that's a great song for Status Quo. And again, absolutely zeitgeist, an absolute summer of love, psychedelic 1967 song.
Yeah, well, I was writing with another fine writer called Ronnie Scott, not the jazz man, but Ronnie Scott, and he wrote for Bonnie Tyler later on, Lost in France, and those tracks. And he was a great writer, we just it worked great for us. I mean, I remember with Jessamine,
I studied
for the chorals,
and I had the chords, and I had initially the chords, and the because I can only play in C on a keyboard, so I was playing in C, and like, what am I? And I was going singing that three, and I'd got so far with it, and I couldn't get any further. And I couldn't get any further. Like, what can you say? I had all that that a girl doesn't want, but it still wouldn't have been anything. And he heard it, and he said, "And Jasmine stays, though time goes fast." Just a slight alteration of the part of the melody, and that was it. It clicked. And he was that kind of guy. He'd come in here. He had the magic, a little bit of that magic ingredient. But
And that was a hit for the Corals, wasn't it?
Corals.
Sorry, the Casuals. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, the
I'm
Casuals.
So sorry. Casuals.
Yeah, yeah. So it's still one of my. I love their record of it, and I just like the sentiment of it. It was such a simple song, but it was a very honest song in a way. It was a. There was something about it that was just simple. It was
beautiful.
There's an honesty about it. I can't explain it, but there was. Yeah, there was.
And Lou, how did Lulu? How did you end up writing? You wrote "I'm a Tiger," didn't you?
Phil? Yeah. Well, I had the hook of "I'm a Tiger," and it was written for children. And I thought it'd be great that this would be great for kids. I'm a tiger, and I could see the kids all dancing to "I'm a Tiger." Yeah, that would work. That really would work. I said to Ron, you know, I said, "Ron, I've got this idea. I'm a tiger." He said, "Okay, sing it to me." So I said, "Well, this is it." And he said, "Okay, and then he came in with a look like a little girl living in a big." I said, "Yeah, that'll work with it." And then we both of us got into it together, and it was meant for children. It never was, and he had a connection. I can't remember how. Oh yeah, it was connection was with Mickey. He was a friend of Mickey's, and he said that was the strange thing. And he said I've taken it to Mickey. I said, "You what?" I said, "Well, the kids song." He said, "Yeah." He said, "Yeah, Lulu." I said, "Lulu?" He said, "Yeah, she could murder this." So I thought about it, and I said, "Hey, hold on a minute. What about Nancy Sinatra? That would be even better, you know, not being funny. I don't want to knock Lulu, but, you know, make more money with Nancy Sinatra." And he said, no. He said, "No, I think Lulu wants going to cut it." But I don't think, and I'm being honest, I don't think Lulu ever liked the song at all. But it wasn't my fault, Lulu, if you're listening. It was written for the youngsters initially, but it worked. I mean, don't get me wrong. It was a hit, so I'm not going to knock it.
Because you like a story, don't you? For you, songwriting is storytelling.
I love it. I love films. I'm writing today. I'm writing. Got my guitar here, and I'm writing a track at the moment of someone who's saying goodbye to someone to go into war. And so I try to build up. It's like Kids in America. All those songs. Cambodia. Cambodia was one of the best lyrics that I came up with. Because he did paint a picture of the terrible goings on in that part of Asia, that part.
Yeah, I know it's an extraordinary subject to present to your daughter as a follow up pit single to Kids in America.
Well, I don't know, but you know who else would touch on a subject like that? Which is it would be Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark.
Yeah.
You know, and it's sonically not a million miles away from them. I mean, it's that lovely motif.
Well, that funny enough, that started out with Rick had got, I think it was a German group, and again it was a computer, and the album, he brought the album into this house here where I'm sitting, and it go don 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 don, almost like ba 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 da ba da da da, almost like a classical piece. I thought, play it again. He goes don 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 ba da ba ba da da. He said, "Yeah, that's an idea." Yep, off we went, bang. He wrote, finished the whole damn thing off, and then initially we'd written it, and I wrote the lyrics down, sitting downstairs at Rack Studios with earphones on, just playing this cassette over and over again, this backing track. I guess that's the way I used to write. And in the end, I love the track, but I thought, well, like you're saying, it won't mean a lie here. And Mickey said, "This is going to be a smash." He always said this when it was going to be a hit. I said, "Do you think so, Mickey? Where?" He said, "France." I said, "France? Do they buy records?" He said, "Do they buy records? Yes, they do." He said, "This is going to be a monster hit." And of course, he was right. And Kids in America, he said, I remember Kids in America, he's playing it on these speakers in rack at full volume. And his wife, his lovely wife, was sitting there as well. And we're all sitting listening to it. He said to me, turn around, he said, what do you think? I said, I definitely think it could make the top 50. He said, the top 50? He said, that's going to make the top 5. Don't worry, even worry about it. And he was that kind of, he was a genius, Mickey. I loved him to bits. He was a tough man in many, many ways, but I loved him to bits. I loved his talent, awesome talent.
How was it for you to see your daughter going off and becoming a... Did you have all the same worries that your dad had about you becoming
a
star?
No, I didn't. The only thing I worried about was not coming up with the right song for her. That was a pressure. And what used to hurt, and it did hurt as well, is at that particular point, Rick and I were writing the songs for her to try and give her a hit. But then I won't say the artist, but one of the artists who would do a cover and it would be number one, and we'd be number six or something like that. And I used to get really choked to think, you know, we could have done covers, and we got Kim to do loads of covers, but we never, we would try to write the hits ourselves. But I used to get really, not almost angry, really, but this other artist here was number one. Why can't we,
Not Shaking Stevens, was it?
Or was it not Shaking. I love it, incidentally. I do love Shaking, and I love Shaking. And I loved his records, you get me wrong. But for someone who was writing the songs, trying to write the hits, and maybe you probably hit the same thing, because it happens to a lot of writers, I tell you, it does. Especially when someone's doing covers, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, a part of your story, Marty, which we have to talk about, is a love story, isn't it? Because one of the reasons that you sort of finished with Larry Parnes, and maybe even finished as a rock star, is you chose love, because you met Joyce, who you're still with now, all those years ago. I mean, and Larry didn't like you, or the idea of you getting married, did he?
No. I mean, I said, I've met a girl. I said, Larry. I said, I want to get married. So he said, I want to get married. So he said, I said, yeah. And so he said, well, all right. He said, well, we'll call somebody. And we had a meeting. And we sat down and we discussed what would happen. And this would affect your career greatly. So I thought, who cares? You know, who gives a damn? I could personally give a damn. You know, again, I just, you know, it was a natural thing for me to do it. I go head first on I'd met this girl. I knew this girl. He said, well, she could be, you know, we could keep her in the background and she could be, you know, in those days, it would have been called a mistress. And I thought, no, I'm not having that. No. She's too good for that. So I said, no. I mean, we could have kept the marriage secret, but then I think the temptation for Larry was the publicity.
Well, as John Lennon tried to with his marriage at the beginning.
Sorry?
John Lennon was sort of keeping his marriage secret initially.
Yeah. Funny enough, you used to mention John Lennon. I remember being very drunk in this house. I got really, really, I don't drink anymore, I must add, but I was in the days when I used to drink, and I got very drunk and I started to cry. I listened to Jealous Guy. And the reason I say that is I heard Jealous Guy today. What a fantastic song it is. And, you know, so many songs, but that hurts me. You know, you were involved, Gary, with songs that, you know, that are phenomenal, that phenomenal song, technically in every other way. And, you know, I want the whole world to hear, you know, when your song, Jealous Guy, you know, all these songs that I love, that they've moved on, you know, they're into... two other things at the time.
It was interesting in the Get Back movie, because you see John already developing that song, don't you, but with completely different lyrics. Am I right to remember that?
Yeah, you're right to remember that, because someone said that there was the story that it was originally, it was he'd ask Yoko to give him a list of all the people he'd slept with, blah blah, but something came out that he maybe said to someone it was actually about Paul.
But what I loved about it, which was the honesty, and that's what, you know, when I was drunk and crying, which I don't have to admit to, but I was a jealous guy, because it was dead right, you know, it was dead right, you know, the ego, you know, you were unsure, you thought they'd done simple basic things about love and you know, but it nevertheless, you know, the honesty of that. The reason I say it, I played it today by someone else, another group were playing it. And I thought,
is it Roxy Music?
No, I think it was, oh, I'll find out for you in a second. I can tell you.
Because I've played it with them.
Ah, Aslan, the Irish. Have you heard that singer? A band? Aslan.
No.
Yeah, and that was one of the tracks. And I thought, my God, yeah. Jealous guy. What a great song. What an honest song. I love honesty. I do love honesty. And I love honesty in lyrics as well.
But back to Joyce, what sort of smart people like Gary have done. But again, you were way, way before the pack. She persuaded you to do things like keep your own publishing, right?
Yes, she did.
Now, was that to do with, and you keep referring to this house, which is clearly a very dearly beloved house. You've clearly been there a long time. Is that the house that you were trying to buy when the prospect of selling your publishing came up?
No. I mean, what had happened was there was an opportunity because we had about 3 in the charts at the time. And we knew that there was going to be a certain amount of money coming in, whatever. And I'd seen this house. I'd come up to Hertfordshire, because moved from Greenwich I come up for the day to see houses in Hertfordshire. And when I saw it, I knew I wanted it. From the moment I fell in love with it. It was an immediate love affair, which has never left me. Every time I come through the gate, it's still a love affair. But I knew that there was going to be money coming in to buy that house, potentially. But it took a long time to come in. One thing I must just go back on about Larry and my marriage. He never stood in the way. He didn't put things in the way and start introducing other women to me or become a pain in the, saying bad things.
He
treated Joyce like a princess, which was really sweet. And I love him.
And of course, out of your marriage to Joyce came Kim and your biggest hit in America ever.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. It was. It was a strange thing. And who knows where it'll go. You know, my grandson, Harry, is a great singer. He's in music and granddaughters and that. They're all in music. Roxanne sings, Kim sings, still on tour. And so it's a strange the way it all came about.
But did you feel frustrated in those early 60s when the Beatles came along and that you'd really smashed the door open for everybody, but you weren't part of that at that moment?
Yeah. Well, in a way, I mean, but I was so in awe of them as well. When I used to work at Liverpool Empire, and one year I worked here, I always remember this. Larry got me in Liverpool Empire 4 times, 4 times in 1 year, which is unusual for an artist to go back like that. And I packed it out each time. McCartney was in one of those audiences. McCartney reminded me of that. He even told me one of the gags I'd said on stage, which was one of the guys who was close to them, he'd bring in magazines with these black and white pictures of this rock band with chains around their neck and longer, slightly like different hairstyles and everything. He said, "This is the Beatles." He said, "They're fan. Have you heard of them, Marty?" So I said, "No." He said, "Oh, they're fantastic." He said, "They're really fantastic. And I'll leave you with the magazine." I said, "All right, you know." Then I'd look at it a bit, and then then towards the end of the year, every time I came there, he'd have these new magazines with the Beatles and something. See, this amateur band or a band now that had gone to Germany and were doing well. And then one day I went to Chester. I was working in Chester in a ballroom and some kids were there, youngsters. And this girl said to me, "I enjoyed your show." I said, "Thank you." She said, "Have you heard of a band called the Beatles?" So I said, "Yes, I have, as it happens." I said, "They're a Liverpool band." She said, "They are absolutely fantastic." I said, "Really?" And the other girls, another girl said, "Oh, they were wonderful." And another girl said, and then and about 10 girls, they're going, "The Beatles are..." I thought, star, they're going to be a star. I knew it. So when Love Me Do came out, I said to Joyce, "See who this is." She said, "Oh my God, yeah, it's the Beatles," you know, because Joyce is from Liverpool. And that was it. I knew. I just knew. And I knew beforehand they were going to be stars, you know.
What was that joke?
Yeah, but more importantly, what was the gag that McCartney reminded you about? You were going to say the same thing, weren't you, Gary? Yeah.
Well, I used to say, ladies and gentlemen, we're very honoured this evening. Somebody has just come into the theatre who I think we should all stand for. Ladies and gentlemen, would you please stand for the president? And they would all stand, and including McCartney and the president, and they'd all stand like that. And I say, of United Dairies, and of course, then they'd all sit down again. He reminded me of the gag. He said, oh, dear.
Oh, but yeah, that's wonderful.
United Dairies. God, you can still pull that one in almost.
You could.
Yeah.
We might. on our next tour.
Marty, thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure, Gary.
I think we covered the bases, didn't we, really, Guy?
We covered everything. Well, I didn't mention, but you, of course, you did a lovely duet with your daughter.
I did. Yes, I did.
Of course. That's
yeah, nice. I did. Sorry seems to be the hardest word.
But you also did that great thing, which is a lovely thing. Was it her 60th birthday, where you kind of joined
we did that one as well. Great. Yeah, we did the 60s world. Great. Yeah, and I wrote that, and I was pleased with that. Yeah, I've learned a lot over this the last few years in many many ways. I'm sort of catching up because the Beatles and all everybody else who are good musicians knew all these tricks all along, but I never did, and so I started to tune the guitars to different, I tuned it to E, and I use that a lot, quite a bit. And when you do that, you're going to hear chords and you can make up completely different sounding chords. They're musical, but then they're different. They're very...
So is there a plan for a new album?
Are there what? I've got these tracks. I can't stop writing. It's embarrassing in a way. Because I think, Marty, you're 84. Come on.
No, but listen, we had Ian Hunter from Mott the Hoople on a few weeks ago. He's 84 as well. He's just got a new album come out, which I love because it's called Defiance Part 1. Right. So, you know, he's planning on quite a few parts going ahead. It's what you do, isn't it? You're not going to stop doing that. But I just wondered if you were going to try and communicate, let the public hear these songs.
I will. I've got. It's funny enough. I got the guitar here. I was playing it just before I joined you. I've got this song which it's like a very laid back song about someone who's leaving to go to war. And although people might tie it in with the Ukraine, I don't want them to do that, really. This could be any time, any soldier, at any point in the future or in the past who had to go to war and had to say goodbye temporarily. And in the song it said, I can't give you the title because the title is a clincher. The title.
You love a good title, don't you?
Fantastic title.
I know. Love Me, Love My Dog.
Oh, my God. We didn't mention that. What song that was. Do you know what? It was one of the first songs I learned to play on guitar.
No.
Playing that song. I don't know why it came up. I think I got the lyrics from one of those Smash Hits magazines before Smash Hits became as we know it in the 80s. It was just the Lyric magazine,
Oh dear! Still, it's all a learning process, and I love finding something new. You know, it can be anything, and can be modern, can be can be from the past. I love a lot of songs from the 30s. I am astounded at how good the lyrics are. A lot of the songs that Sinatra sang, some of those lyrics, and then you go to, South Pacific, as melody and lyrics and the ideas. And I've loved so. My life is full of just joy, really, because I'm listening all the time to, almost every damn minute, almost of the day. The only strange thing with me, with my writing, and I don't know if you're the same, Gary, is that I'll get a day where it's the last thing in the world I want to do is to write a song. I do not want to go anywhere near it, and I just have one complete silence, and then I'll go to bed that night and think, blimey, I've lost it. I've lost the. Yeah. The next day, of course, I wake up, bang, and it's all back again. But
amazing.
I have these times when it's the last thing I want to hear is a new lyric but I don't know why that is. But when it does come back, it's intense. It's absolutely intense. I can't stop
it. It's about self-belief, isn't it? Always about self-belief.
I'll tell you one thing before we go. We mentioned about Lionel Bart. And one thing which fascinated me with Lionel, now Lionel would sit with us, we're all songwriters and sitting around with the sods, and you analyze how he wrote those songs for the great songs for the musicals. He didn't write music.
That's right. Didn't play an instrument.
Well, I went to my chiropodist, it sounds weird, a chiropodist in Barnet, he died. He's no longer alive anymore. A lovely Jewish man.
He's six feet under.
Yeah.
Sorry, it's not a chiropodist. That's a terrible chiropodist joke that just came into my head.
Oh, Gary. And, sorry. He said to me,
God, those feet.
Anyway. He was finishing off my feet. And he said, you know, Lionel? I said, yes, I do. Very well. So he said, I've did a lot of the work for him. I said, did you? He said, yeah. He said, I used to convert what he'd written on from the piano. And my mind went back to a time when I went to Lionel. Lionel wrote me a song. He didn't write for me, but he wrote this song, which wasn't particularly good as it happens in my opinion. But he wrote, and when I saw Lionel's piano, it had things like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And when you looked at his sheet for these melody lines, it was 6, 12, 24, and that's how that man got those. And that, you think of the great musicians and the great technical people that have been in our still in our sods. And that man worked that way to get some of the most incredible melody lines, catchy melody lines, great lyrics, of course, but...
Irving Berlin? Like,
I've got an amazing picture. You remember, Gary, it used to be up in my studio, of Lionel sitting at the desk and my dad sitting at the piano, because that's how they had the room set up. And it's really nice. It's dedicated to my dad. Just goes, and then we wrote Love, Lionel. So that's how it used to be. My dad would play.
I mean, I think it's Irving Berlin. People can correct me on social media. Only played the black notes, and he had a lever.
B flat. He only played in B
flat. And he had a lever on the side of his piano so he could change the key but still play the same white notes in B flat. We all have our methods. I've actually seen Marty play get up on stage with Kim and with Ricky not that long ago at one of these SODs, Society of Distinguished Songwriters, events. And, oh, my God, man, there's so much charisma when he gets up on stage. I tell you, it's mind-blowing. You know exactly what Larry Parnes saw.
Oh, well, it's nice of you to say that. But this time of my life, I've never viewed myself as anything special. I don't even think about it too much at all. In fact, quite the reverse. I view myself as sort of like still learning, and you know, like a learner, where all the other artists were so accomplished and everything else. So I don't have any. I don't have high conceit. I'm proud, obviously, of a lot of things that I was involved with, but I don't have colossal conceit. I just think it's just part of life. And whenever I think I'm good, of course, I hear Jealous Guy or one of the Beatles songs or one of the Queen songs or one of your songs. And you think, oh, hold on a minute, you know, you sit back there, boy, listen to this, you know. So I'm always kept on an even keel, as they say.
All right, mate. Listen, you better get back to learning your speeding.
Yeah, he comes in at
road traffic controls or whatever.
Speed awareness course. I've done a couple of them, and you're right. It changes everything for about 6 months. Then it's all gone.
Then I'll be speeding again.
All right, mate. Listen, so nice to talk to you, and
joy to meet you.
Looking forward to seeing you
guys. All right, and thanks for the interest. You know, I'm humbled. Thank you.
You live in a part of rock and roll history that is, you know, that extraordinary moment when it started to blossom into something that we still believe in today. You know, you were one of those very first people.
Yeah.
You have to be on this show.
And we thank you for your service.
Oh, and I thank you for listening to an old 84-year-old man rambling.
It's so beautiful, isn't he?
So beautiful. Sprightly, I believe, is the word that one may apply.
He looked cool in those glasses and his shirt. And he's
very,
got the quiff
cool.
Still. Yeah. And he's still...
You also seem to have a very good camera. Did you notice he was beautifully sharp?
You're worried about that, aren't you? You're comparing his camera to your camera, aren't you?
Well, of course I am.
Am I sharp and in focus?
No, you never have been.
You're blurred in real life. That's the problem.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
focus has never been my strong point.
I love that. And if you want to make some connections with Marty, I guess in our past episodes, I suppose Hank Marvin is in there, isn't he? Because Brian Bennett was one of Marty's was musicians. He was his drummer who went on to join the Shadows.
Well, that's I think that the thing is that rather than joining the dots, what's amazing is that Marty joins his own dots,
yeah,
through to the Aces and beyond, yeah, you know, with
totally unique.
That's what's amazing with that. Do you know what's funny? So I'll tell you a little something, is that I was really relieved when he said I didn't meet Lionel Bart till years later, because when I brought up my dad earlier and he just skirted it, and I thought, oh shit, I think there's a beef. And look, he just didn't know. He just wasn't around then.
We make some extras, don't we, Guy? We make Rock on Tour extras.
We do make extras, and you can have them. And they're, I'm sure there'll be some from here. And all you have to do is go to rockontours.com and sign up for them. And you will be rewarded
richly.
Become
a subscriber, as it were. And yes, there's lots of things you can get through that. And thank you for listening once more, and we thank Ian, who's produced us today, for Gimme Sugar, because Ben is trapped in Canada. I think he's gone over there to Nickelback or something,
film. Yeah, see Nickelback, and I think trapped by wildfires, I guess.
I suppose so, yeah, smoke. Safe journey back for him, and so it's good night from me.
And good night from them.
Rock on Tours is produced by Gimme Sugar Productions for Warner Music Group UK.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.